And good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio, science and technology in a complicated world that's interesting, fun, and understandable. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peake. We have a fascinating show for you this morning. Our first guest, William Miller, author of The Microcosm Within, Evolution and Extinction in the Hologenome. And we're going to define that for you in a little while, because we didn't know what it was before we got the book. The Microcosm Within takes its readers on a sweeping scientific journey that reorganizes our thinking about our biological selves, evolution, and extinction. Darwin has dominated evolution for over a century, but many issues remain puzzling, including the biggie. Does natural selection really account for evolution?
And good morning, John. I'm Lynn Ware Peake. Our second guest this morning is Ted Claypool. He's the co-author of the book Privacy in the Age of Big Data, Recognizing Threats, Defending Your Rights, and Protecting Your Family. Digital data collection and surveillance gets more pervasive and invasive by the day, but the best ways to protect yourself and your data are all steps you can take yourself. The devices we use to get just-in-time coupons, directions when we're lost, and maintain connections with loved ones, no matter how far away they are, also invade our privacy in ways we might not even be aware of. Our guest will tell us what we can do to protect ourselves. You're listening to Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW. We'll be right back.
This is Chris Robinson with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we've been supporting KPCW since day one. Prudential Utah helps buyers and sellers with their home needs, whether it's a condo, single-family house, or undeveloped land. Our agents know our community and our local market. More information can be found at pru-utah.com.
Hi, this is JP, repair manager for Cole Sport, a local KPCW supporter. Our repair shop is ready to go with our precision ski tuning equipment from Montana of Switzerland and repair and wax supplies from Swix. Open daily with overnight service, we are ready to help you slide and glide through the season. Cole Sport, expect the unexpected.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peake. Our first guest, William Miller, author of The Microcosm Within, Evolution and Extinction in the Hologenome. What is the origin of self-sacrifice? Does natural selection really account for evolution? Why is homosexuality commonplace in the animal kingdom? Why were the arms of the Tyrannosaurus Rex so small? Why do some species go extinct, yet others endure? Well, The Microcosm Within offers intriguing and profound answers by exploring our extraordinary world of cellular consciousness, connections, and collaboration. William, welcome
Yes.
to Cool Science Radio.
Well, thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Yeah. William, let's start with the word hologenome. Can you define that for us all?
Certainly. When you look into a mirror, John or Lynn, you naturally see yourselves as a single being. You can't help but do that. You look in the mirror, you see yourself as one particular entity. But the interesting thing that we've learned through a lot of new scientific advances is that that is not how nature sees you. Nature sees you in an entirely different way. You are a collaboration. You are a vast network of different cellular environments. Those environments include your own personal cells, the John cells or the Lynn cells or my cells, but also a huge amount of microbial life, which is a necessary part of your health. In fact, that amount of microbial life is so large that it's really 10 times greater the number of microbial cells than your own personal cells. And if you look at just the genetic material inside those microbial cells, the amount of what we used to term as foreign genetic material is 100 times larger than the amount of genetic material in your own regular cells. The net result of all this is that you can't live without them, and they can't live without you in the kinds of environments that they want to be in. And so the end result is you're this big, huge network of cellular ecologies all linked together into the one being that you see in the mirror. And Darwinian evolution concentrates on that one single being, and what the hologenome is about and hologenomic evolution, which follows from that, is understanding that you are this collaborative. You are this big, huge, working network.
And why this is important, for an example, as you point out in the book, that for many generations, physicians were taught that stomach ulcers, for an example, were caused by excess acid production, but they're in fact caused by a microbial infection. So the better that we understand our world of microbes, the better we understand ourselves?
Absolutely. When you begin to understand that you are different from the way that you've always been taught to think of yourself, that you are, instead of just being one thing, you're a total network of things, then medicine has to change. The evolutionary process that constructed you to be that kind of a hologenomic being has to be a different pathway than you've been taught. And there are other important implications for genetic therapy and other things like that. So it's really a profound difference. The science is there now. The difference is that we've come to understand that this is new reality.
Hmm. William, it's funny, literally 15 minutes ago, John and I were talking about looking at ourselves in the mirror, but what we were saying was, how did we get to look this old?
I'm not going to say what I was saying.
Who is that old person in the mirror? And, I'd like to blame that on the microbes. How about that?
Well, I haven't thought about that one. You have to give me time. Maybe I can blog on that when I figure that one out.
It's just a bit of
Lynn
a coincidence.
Has really nice microbes.
So, let's go back to maybe where this whole hologenome concept and theory started. I believe it was back in the 1980s with Richard Jefferson talking about, how we are just this unit of performance, and you can look at these microbes as little, workers that create the, or that are part of the cog of this big industry, which is us, the being,
exactly.
The performance unit. So that's a good way. And you've explained it really well here. I'm wondering, one of the things also is that microbiologists like you, they love it. They love this theory because they've always said that bacteria come first, right? Their bacteria and microbes are the most important, beyond any greater being or any greater element. So I guess, I'd like you to explain maybe how this furthers and contrasts with Darwin's theory.
That's a terrific question. The important thing, once you understand that you are different than you were before, you start to ask the why of it. And that's where things start to diverge from Darwinian narrative of natural selection. The reason you are this collaborative network is because, as tough as it is for any of your listeners to accept this, and I have doctor friends that still can't accept this, each of the cells, each of the microbes, and each of your own cells have their own limited level of awareness. It's not thinking like you and I think. They're not sitting there and making discrete choices in the same way that you and I might do that. But they have their own little world within their own scale and their own limits of preference, of awareness, and furthermore, the tiniest little bit of an ability to adjust. That is what really separates a system of the kind that I'm talking about from Darwinian selection. Once you have cells that are aware, both microbes and your own cells, those cells can cooperate to enhance their environments, and they can do a thing called natural genetic engineering. They work together in a collaborative way, and over the course of time and an extensive amount of linkages of all of these networks, you can end up with the kinds of marvelous beings that we have. In fact, if you look at the brain as a good for instance, and you start to understand the way it functions, there are centers of cognition within the brain that are all scattered all over the brain. It didn't build up layer by layer from a central point. It's the prototype of the sort of a thing that would come together by a huge linking process of connection. So in order for these connections to occur, you really need an underlying impulse. And science has taught us that level of impulse, that awareness is there. as a physician, I could see that the patterns of disease reproduce themselves so frequently that as doctors, we would make a prediction of what kind of microbe would cause one kind of disease or what kind of pathologic process would cause another. Our whole ability to help the patient was based on being able to predict the action of cells, of microbes. But we never gave it any thought. Why were we able to do that? And the answer is because these cells, instead of being just stupid and or insensible and just hitting things by chance, have preferences. And that's why disease patterns are so recurring, so that you can make a prediction and help a patient.
Mm. So the medical community, probably in the last 20 years, I might be wrong with that, but has started to embrace the notion that intelligence is distributed down to the cellular level. And now what you're saying is that there is also a collaboration with the microbial element of an organism. And if the medical community were to embrace that, how would that affect the research that is going into all of the major challenges that we're trying to tackle?
It would affect things profoundly, John. The difference is, maybe the best way for your listeners to understand it is, in Eastern medicine, you know, Asian medicine, there was the concept in the background of the balance of forces. They would talk about sources of energy. They talk about qi. They talk about adjusting your balance. And in Western medicine, we've never paid any attention to that. We're drugs-centered. You think you target things really specifically with a specific drug, and that conquers that particular infection. And a lot of those things work spectacularly. The next area of medical discovery, and what will be very important going forward, is to look at all of these microbes. Let's take diseases of the gut, you know, problems with digestion, problems with inflammatory bowel disease. We're beginning to understand it for medical therapy that to treat that best requires adjusting the microbial community in the gut. And there's a lot of medical research that's starting to focus around that. The gut is simply the most obvious one, but every single other area of our body could, medical research will over time direct itself to adjusting balance, adjusting the balance of the gut environment or the environment of your oral cavity. There are people that are beginning to understand that heart disease can be linked very directly to gum disease. It's not intuitively obvious, but that's the new kind of medical understanding that we're coming to, and these will have very important implications going down the line.
So, Dr. Miller, this is pretty heartening type of thing that you're talking about, because as we've seen that, you know, there's this opposition between allopathic medicine and naturopathic medicine, and only it seems recently have sort of the conventional medical world started to embrace the more holistic or integrative medical world. I think it's been more because it's sort of the trend, and it's a direction they've needed to go to remain innovative and viable, maybe. But what you're saying is at the very, you know, basis of science, that's what it's showing as well. I think that's great.
I think it is, too, because, you know, I was a traditional physician and was very proud of the work that I was able to do. But you're taught to really be disdainful of some of the other branches of medical knowledge, medical science. They're not doing real science. They're not doing real things. Well, what we have now is an unusual opportunity to start to explore the richness and the very important collaborative process within ourselves, so that many of the principles that were used by some of the other sciences that we would consider the soft medical sciences, that there was something to them that could be valuable, akin to, I think you can remember when acupuncture was considered ridiculous, and then acupuncture has now been considered a prime form of alternative form of therapy, and there's been an awful lot of excellent research talking about how acupuncture alters gateways of neuroreceptors. Mm-hmm. And really hard science based on this. That's where we are now onto other things. We need to understand our ability to avoid mood swings. We probably have to understand a good deal about our gut and a good deal about our oral cavity. I mean, this sounds almost ridiculous, but all of these things are linked. When you understand that you need to re-envision yourself compared to what you were, uh-huh. and there are linkages that need to be explored, and good science, very, very strictly done science, is beginning to accept that and to honor that. Let me give an example. There's a company that's been formed. It's a young company called OmniBiome Therapeutics. Part of what they're doing, for example, is exploring preterm labor, which is a huge, expensive proposition for the medical world and can be very devastating for mothers and babies. It turns out that there's a very good evidence that preterm labor is caused by an imbalance in the vaginal flora that has an opportunity to get past the cervical mucus plug and up into the uterus and affect the womb. We used to think that the contents of the womb, the amniotic fluid, was sterile, but it's not. In fact, it's probably true that at least half of all preterm births are due to some level of infection that we have not been able to understand before. But to understand infection, you have to understand balance. You have to understand what's there normally. And then you can move on to trying to treat it and prevent preterm labor, for instance. The other thing is, in order for us to understand where we've come from, in an evolutionary sense, we have to understand what we are as a hologenomic organism. And from that then come crucially different understandings of evolution and extinction with other important future implications for ourselves. You know, one of the things that's really interesting to me, and it might be interesting to your readers, when you look at the Darwinian narrative, there's almost no attention paid to immunology. Well, you know how important immunology is in medicine and much of what we do in medical science. It was incredible to me as a physician starting down a path of interest in evolution that evolutionary biologists really paid no heed to immunology. They didn't think they needed to. But as our science matures and we become better and better at it and better informed, we understand that immunology is the key to everything.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Dr. William Miller. He's been a physician in academic and private practice for over 30 years. He's joining us to talk about his book, The Microcosm Within, Evolution and Extinction in the Hologenome. And I just want to ask you a quick question about immunology. And as it relates to the Darwinian theory, isn't it just part of survival of the fittest? Isn't it just wrapped into this thing? Or is it just hasn't been defined and examined?
Well, it is, of course. There's no way to separate it out. That when I say that it has been paid little heed, compared to the emphasis that it should be, there's no question that immunology determines survival of an organism from before conception right through death. And it's not as if those things have been completely ignored. But the origin of species is not related to natural selection per se. It is an immunological event. And if you read my book, and I hope that some of your listeners will, they'll be able to learn why it's immunological interplay that is the crucial difference and the factor that has been to which little attention has been paid that allows for the origin of species, that allows for the great variety of creatures that we have, and governs our survival. And in fact, also will govern extinction events as they occur in the future.
Mm-hmm. It's absolutely amazing that all of this happened within 3,000 years, isn't it, Dr. Miller?
Exactly. Absolutely right.
I'm curious, and obviously you're curious. In reading your book, you have to be curious to write the book that you did. With all the questions that are on the table for you, what one question would you like to see answered answered yet?
I think that the most important question that remains unanswered is one that I take the privilege of not directly exploring, because there is no current answer, and you have to begin somewhere from which an answer can be derived. The really important things that are left unsolved, from my perspective, are the origin of multicellularity. Why did one cell start to want to be associated with another cell? Mm. And the biggest question, and the one I'm not sure we'll ever have an answer to, is the origin of consciousness. Where does awareness come from? So in my work, what I present, which is a very complete and detailed and very cogent alternative to Darwinian evolution, and the first person to really do that in a complete and scientifically rigorous way, I start from the point where there is cellular awareness, where there is cellular consciousness, what we call cognition. That cognition, though, I take as endowment, basic endowment, just as Darwin started from his point. Darwin's point was faithful reproduction. People don't think that Darwin worked from faith, but he had to accept on faith that cells and organisms could faithfully reproduce, or he had no system of natural selection. So I've taken the privilege of starting from the point where I know the good science begins, which is cells are aware, cells have cognition. But the real question is, where does that start from? And that may be metaphysical and may be beyond us forever, but that's the question I'd like to have answered. That's the big unknown.
Mm. That's, you know, you have really morphed your whole career and your field of interest and expertise into something really fascinating. I mean, does the world just keep getting bigger and bigger for you?
Well, I can offer your listeners a couple of things that I felt were unique, but I think that it's available to everyone. First of all, a level of curiosity, and then the internet. So let me just explain really quickly. Part of what got all this started for me is I'm a physician. I have no particular background in evolution when I get started, and I go with a colleague to a big medical meeting in Chicago. And I don't know if you know Chicago at all, but they have the Field Museum, mm-hmm. a terrific natural history museum. And this is just about the time, this is the first time that I got to see Sue, the Tyrannosaurus Rex.
I was just about to mention that's where Sue is.
I don't know how many of your listeners have had a chance to see this thing, but it is eye-popping. It is something else. But I'm looking at this thing, and two things occur to me. One is, you got to look at those little arms. They just don't make any sense. They're these little tiny flappy. I mean, they've got big long claws on those appendages. But and I'm sure they were effective for certain things. But they're just completely out of scale. This beast is huge, and these arms are minuscule in comparison. The other thing I noticed, because I was an imager and I looked at a lot of X-rays and things, the bones, of course, are huge, but the anatomy of them, the parts of the bones, for example, the top leg bone, the femur bone, or the top arm bone, the humerus bone, or the shape of the pelvis, the shape of the hips, the vertebrae, they were all just like humans and many other animals. I'm thinking, I don't really understand anything. I don't see how this can possibly be the way it is. Well, in our era of the internet, a guy like me can get a passion, and with a sufficient curiosity and a little bit of perseverance, contribute something important. And it's the combination of curiosity but the enabling power of the internet that is so different from 50 years ago. If I had to go to a university library to get all the great scientific journals that I use in my book, there are 800 references. And I didn't even make any of them up. It's just the richness of the bounty that the internet offers you to improve your ability to know things, to research things. We live in a terrific age. This is a very different experience than science had in the past. That this is an opportunity for people with active interests and some diligence to make a contribution in an area where they thought they might not. And any of your listeners could do this if the level of their own personal passion rose high enough.
And it's interesting, as we do the show and we have a number of different guests, that one of the common themes, as we speak to a to a nanotechnologist or to a paleontologist or if we speak to a biologist, is the huge amount of collaboration that is going on now that wasn't going on 20 and 30 years ago between artists, biologists, genealogists, and all these different groups sharing information. And, of course, the internet is a vehicle that allows them to share and collaborate and the types of breakthroughs that are occurring because of that collaboration.
Well, John, this is a really important point to me. You're completely right. You're completely correct. There's a very fine scientist up in Chicago named James Shapiro. He's written a book about cellular cognition and things like that. And in the course of his book, he makes the point that we've reached a time in science where progress can still be made on the details, knowing more and more about a small thing. But it's really going to be necessary for people from differing backgrounds to come into science and offer their unique perspective. They bring a different form of reasoning. And so that's why I can contribute as a background as a physician and not originally an evolutionary biologist, because I come to it with a completely different set of experiences. I don't come to it with the same training and biases, and I can bring new thoughts from medicine, for example, a thorough understanding of immunological processes and things like that. Evolutionary biologists, but that's not just part of their training. So we do live, John, in an era where you can bring talent, interests, and unusual points of view from disparate groups of people that would not normally have contributed. The only thing that needs to be done is make sure that opportunities, just like your own radio station, exist for these ideas to spread out. Mm. Because it's not always true that the academic community is yearning to have an outsider step into their territory. That's not a common narrative either. But when you have the internet's available, when you have a terrific radio show such as your own that are on, where messages can get out, people can hear about new thoughts and different ideas, then they can make their own decisions. People are smart. They can make their own decisions about what makes sense to them and what doesn't.
They absolutely are. And one of the things that we learned on a past show as well, and we learn, you know, we learn a lot on these shows, is that it used to be being the smartest person in the room would really get you pretty far, but you don't have to be the smartest person in the world anymore, in the room anymore. You need to be the person that knows the best way to use the resources available to you, including the internet.
Absolutely.
Especially the internet.
You know, John, one thing that's really important, and I think this is something that your listeners, I think, intuitively know, nothing beats passion and diligence. You know, the willingness to be at it. You don't have to be the smartest person. You have to have a willingness to dig into it right up to your elbows and develop your own point of view. But certainly you do not have to be the smartest person anymore.
That's right. So it's radical humility and reckless enthusiasm will get you far. Well, we want to thank you very much, Dr. William Miller, author of The Microcosm Within, Evolution and Extinction in the Hologenome. You've got a great book, fascinating guest. We've really enjoyed this conversation, William.
Thanks. It's been my privilege.
Hey, one question before you go, Dr. Yes. Miller. Do you have a blog or anything aside from your book that, you know, we can go and catch your latest ideas?
Yes. I'm going to be more actively blogging, but I have a website, www.themicrocosmwithin.com, and I'm going to start posting on a pretty regular basis. I think your listeners will be interested. The first blog I put up, just to try to tantalize anyone who came on, the site is entitled "Are We Microbial Earthships?" I'll let you guys tune in for that one. I like stuff that gets people to think because it makes me become more flexible in my thinking. Of course, not all the answers are yes, but still, it's a lot of fun to explore these questions. There's so many interesting and actually spectacular implications from all the new science that's happening.
We'd very much like to have you on the show again, so expect our call.
I'd love it. Thanks so much.
Okay, thank you.
Thank
Dr.
you.
Miller.
Okay, bye-bye.
Well, fascinating conversation. We will be back after these messages.
Jan, guess who?
What?
What do you mean, what?
Wait, what's going on?
When?
When? Or where?
Well, where do you think?
About what?
Huh?
Questioning your weekend plans?
Find out what to do, where to go, who to see.
And who's on first this fun Friday.
Clearly brought to you by
Zermatt Resort and Spa.
Homestead Resort.
Foothill Oriental Rugs.
Wasatch Pub, Squatters Pub and Brewery.
Summit County Business Directory.
Why, it's simple.
Tune in.
Tuna.
This is Michelle from Peak Art and Frame, proud supporters of KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame features local photography and artwork, as well as digital printing, custom framing, and mirrors. Open 7 days a week, rush service available, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801, peakartandframe.com.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host, John Wells. We were just speaking with Dr. William Miller, author of Microcosm Within, a very fascinating book. And our next guest is soon to join us. Privacy is complex and personal. Many of us do not know the full extent to which data is collected, stored, aggregated, and used. As recent revelations indicate, we're subject to a level of data collection and surveillance never before imaginable. While some of these methods may, in fact, protect us and provide us with information and services we deem to be helpful and desired, others can turn out to be insidious and overarching. We need help navigating this minefield, and our next guest is here to help us. It's Ted Claypool joining us, co-author of Privacy in the Age of Big Data, Recognizing Threats, Defending Your Rights, and Protecting Your Family. Ted, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you, Lynn. It's great to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. And, you know, I thought maybe we would just start with, I know for myself, I became aware of our lack of privacy way back when, it's a story that you start your book off. Remember the teenagers who were issued computers?
Yep, the lower Marion School District outside Philadelphia.
Yeah, and you know, that was in 2009, so, you know, roughly 5 years ago. But it was, I think, the first time that many people realized, wow, can this really be done? Can this really happen? Talk about that a little bit and why you start your book off with that.
Well, I want to tell you, we used to have when I worked in-house at Bank of America, we used to have a little video that we would show the executives, and this was in 1999, in which an organization of hackers called the Cult of the Dead Cow had created a system that they could take over other people's computers from a distance and take pictures, basically, and watch what was going on with the cameras. And so our executives always just fell all over themselves once they saw what could happen. But 10 years later, those programs aren't hacker programs. They're built into a number of computers. And when you receive computers from somebody else, you may or may not be able to tell whether they've put in a program that they can remotely control your computer, including the camera. And in the Lower Marion School District, the school district had lent out computers to its students, but then was looking in their homes and in the students' bedrooms through the cameras on the computer. And it was found out when a student was actually disciplined because the principal at his school said that he was able to see pictures of the kid taking drugs in his own room.
Yeah.
Now, the child said it was Mike and Ike candies.
Right.
But essentially the principal admitted, you know, we're looking into your bedroom if you're taking our equipment.
Yeah. And I think that back then, I read that maybe the school district settled out of court or something, paid four kids $350,000. Can you imagine now, just 5 years later, what kind of lawsuit that would be and how much bigger it would be? It was so egregious and so blatant.
Oh, well, no question, but we're still having those lawsuits. Last summer, or actually a little farther back than that, I think it was two summers ago now. I'm getting old. These move fast.
Yeah.
But two summers ago, the Federal Trade Commission sued and then got a consent order with a bunch of different rent-to-own companies who were doing the same thing. They had a security system on computers that they were renting to people, and if somebody said, well, I've lost the computer, they say, well, no, you didn't. We're looking at your wife right now who's using it at home.
Right. Ted, I had a question for you. I'm familiar with the web watcher type products that they can monitor somebody else's email, instant messages, chat, social media. They can see the web page the person visits. Maybe they can interrogate the camera and turn that on when they want to, or the microphone, those sorts of things. The types of products that really scare me are keystroke capture, which I think were originally put together by the FBI. It's a sophisticated piece of software. And the first question I have for you is how pervasive is that? Is that something that the neighborhood hacker has access to, or is that mostly large governments?
No, absolutely neighborhood hacker.
Okay.
And not just neighborhood hacker, but you can buy straightforward industrial versions to use with your employees, for example.
Okay. So here's my question. You're home. You're sitting in front of your laptop. Your laptop's connected to your wireless network that's very heavily encrypted. It's well protected. You log on to your brokerage account. You use a password that automatically changes every time you use it. You know, one of those one password type products.
Right.
While in your brokerage account, you transfer some cash around. Maybe you take some cash out or some sort of transaction. If somebody has Keystone Capture and you put that one password in, that changes the next time that it's used. But if they can pick up Keystone Capture, then if they have Keystone Capture, then they can actually pick up that sort of central password, the main password, and they can use that for any of your accounts. Would I be correct in saying that?
Well, yeah, possibly. But, I mean, if you have an account that changes the password every time, then if they captured your last time's password, that's all they have. They can't break in to the next time's password. The problem is with people who, as you point out, John, you know, there are some people that use the same password for everything.
Right.
Yes.
But in essence, you would use the same password. In other words, you go to a company, I think it's called 1Password, one of the companies, and you give them all these passwords for all of these different vehicles that you need to get into. And you actually put in the central password, and then they, behind the scenes, are automatically changing it for you. If somebody has Keystone Capture and they pick up that one password, then, you know, it's Katie bar the door. They can do anything they want.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, that's one of the things that we all have to remember about security, is that for anything to be valuable, we have to be able to use it, right?
Right.
Well, if you have to use it, that means you have to be able to access it. And if you can access it, then somebody else can access it, even if they're just pretending they're you. And what you're describing there is, you know, somebody that has used the keystroke capture to capture your, you know, the strokes you use, the actual things, you know, type letter by letter, number by number, figure by figure into your keyboard, and to use that as if they were you and offer it the same places. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that this kind of thing has been going on a long time, and there are other even more sophisticated ways to do it. For example, when I was working with CompuServe back in the 90s, there were a group of hackers who had figured out how to hack in. Even though we had all of our passwords encrypted, they figured out where the encryption hash started and where it stopped. And they used that piece of code to just plug it in as if it were the password, and it worked.
Was that based on inside information, or
nope.
Was that something they did on the outside?
They tested it themselves till they figured it out. It was a bunch of 16, 17-year-old kids in rural Sweden.
Wow.
And they just figured it out. And of course, they stole millions of dollars worth of service for this. And the police in that case said, as they often do, oh, well, boys will be boys. Because the police, in many cases, don't understand how to handle digital crime.
Right. Yeah, we haven't caught up with it yet.
It's not what they're used to dealing with.
Yeah. Our guest is Ted Claypool. He has co-written a book along with Teresa Payton. It's called Privacy in the Age of Big Data, Recognizing Threats, Defending Your Rights, and Protecting Your Family. And Ted, as a technology attorney, you're very much on the inside of this world. And I think many of us, when we hear, it's such a current topic, we hear about it almost every day on the news, but many of us gloss over because we don't really understand how it happens. Tell us what the biggest couple of threats are to us that we don't know are going on.
I will. And one of the things you have to think of first is who would be those threats? In other words, who wants your information? Because for each of us, the threat would be different.
Right.
For example, we've heard all the Edward Snowden information, but many of us, while we may find it creepy and unconstitutional that the federal government may be taking this information or may know more about you than you think, many of us are not threatened by that.
Exactly.
But when Google takes all this information, or when other big businesses take this information, that may be more threatening to you. Clearly, some of it is available to criminals, and that is, in and of itself threatening to you. And then there are even the more scary things like your neighbors or your mother-in-law can use some of this information or use some of these methods to find out more about you, or even just see what you put on about yourself online or what your friends and other contacts say about you online. So, one of the things that's makes us most vulnerable is ourselves.
Yes.
Right.
Particularly
yes.
When we're dealing with social media, because social media encourages us to give as much information as possible, and many of us do. And that in of itself can be a problem. For example, and we've seen this recently on an insurance ad, so it's good to see other people recognizing it, but if you type in your Facebook page that I'm off to Bora Bora for 2 weeks...
Guess what?
Yeah, you might as well say, please rob me,
right?
Because I won't be there.
Ted, in your book, you talk about a powered sticker. It's a Bluetooth-powered sticker that you can apply to an item that you don't want to lose. So maybe you're in the habit of losing your wallet, your keys, your phone, and then you use these apps to help you track them. And that's not the interesting part. The interesting part is what you state afterwards, which is whenever a technology makes life – and this is what you state in the book, and I really agree with this. Whenever a technology makes life easier, you have to ask yourself, will this technology betray me? Will some bad people be able to track my keys, my wallet, my whatever? So common sense goes –
an interesting thing right now, John, in that a lot of companies are looking at putting RFID tags in their merchandise. So when you would buy something, it could easily be scanned and checked out, and they easily know what inventory is there and what inventory is gone when it's leaving. So, there are very good reasons to do that. But if you have RFID tags on everything in your house or on many of the things you've bought, it's quite possible that somebody driving by your house with a scanner could find what you have in there.
Right.
If you're looking for a big TV to steal,
Yeah.
You just drive by somebody's house and see if they have one.
Right. In the interest of time, can you give us maybe the top five or six things that people can do to protect their privacy?
Absolutely. Like I said before, one of them is be careful with what you say online, because you are publishing this information and it's going out there and you will lose control of it. So just be careful what you say. That's thing one. Thing two, for me anyway, is when you're going around with your mini computer that's pocket-sized, your smartphone, be careful what is turned on with that phone. Because if you have the Wi-Fi turned on, then it becomes a great signaling device for anyone to pick up and tap into the phone and follow you geographically using the Wi-Fi signals, and stores are doing that right now. So I would say one thing is to turn off the Wi-Fi and the Bluetooth on your phone as you wander around, particularly airports and particularly overseas.
Okay. You say stores are using this right now.
Yes, there are stores that are using it because they want to know, you know, if you're spending lots of time at, you know, at the jeans rack or the dress rack.
Yeah, okay.
You know, and they want to know where you go after you left them and how long you're spending in their store.
So in the case of Target, if you went in there and you bought products that would suggest that you were expecting a baby, or you were hoping to have a baby, or maybe a pregnancy test or something like that, they would go back and they would start marketing to you baby-type products.
Absolutely, and they've been doing that for 10 years.
Right. Yeah. One of the other things you mentioned is you got to be careful when you go into a coffee shop that has an unencrypted hotspot. Because you're sitting, you're having a cup of coffee, and maybe you jump on your brokerage account or your checking account, and that is just basically asking for trouble.
Right. That's one of the big things I haven't gotten to yet, which is don't use your computer and tap into the internet unless you know where the signal's coming from and you know that it's secure. I mean, you could just be tapping into not Starbucks Wi-Fi, but the Wi-Fi of the guy upstairs, you know, who is taking all the information off your computer or just routing it through his system. So if he just calls his, you know, Starbucko's system and you tap into it, you're just sending all your information through somebody else. And when you do that at the airport in particular, you know, you really don't know what you're getting and who else could be tapping in or listening.
Right. All right. And so those are pretty easy things. Anything else that rises to the top is something easy we can do or avoid?
Well, this is a terrible one to have to think about, but, I mean, be careful where you're leaving your DNA. You know, and that may be anything from not spitting on the ground, not leaving cups behind unless you throw them in the trash can. You know, we've found that there are actually people that are DNA hunting celebrities and selling their DNA online. And we've even reported in the book about there was a plot on Prince Harry to essentially take his DNA. They set up a honey trap for him in Portugal and were hoping to take his DNA and try and prove that that his father wasn't really his father.
Wow. That's just plain creepy.
I think another good common sense.
What I'm saying is that it's interesting because, you know, when you're at the doctor's office, they will protect your DNA very tightly because that's the law. On the other hand, the law enforcement thinks of you as one big sloshing, slogging sack of DNA that spills it all over the place, and they can take it and do whatever they want with it.
Right.
And so I would say you have to be fairly careful anymore about who you're allowing to, take biological information from you.
Yeah.
I think another common sense thing that has sort of a, you know, will help a lot of people is to actually power down your laptop at night.
No question.
And because if somebody has an opportunity to use WebWatcher to be able to grab anything that you're doing or keystroke capture, they can't do it when the laptop is powered down. So that's
right. Well, to add
that's
to
something
that,
we can all do.
A lot of people are using or a lot of the bad guys will want to not just take your information, but they might want to use your computer in their own zombie computer network for their own purposes, whether it's calculation or right. attacking somebody else. And if you power it down when you're not using it, you greatly reduce the chances of something like that happening.
Right. Well, the book is Privacy in the Age of Big Data, Recognizing Threats, Defending Your Rights, and Protecting Your Family. It's co-written by Teresa Payton and our guest, Theodore Claypool. And Ted, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me, Lynn.
And this is Cool Science Radio, right here on KPCW, only in Park City, only on KPCW. I want to thank both of our guests today, Ted Claypool. That was very interesting. And also Dr. William Miller, again, that guy was really interesting. I would like to follow his blogs. He makes science accessible. Interesting.
Yeah. Hey, Lynn, I wanted to mention that it is National Engineers Week, February 16th through the 22nd. And for National Engineers Week, I just wanted to mention about a couple of our universities here. The College of Engineering at the University of Utah has doubled the number of degrees awarded since 1999, fueling Utah's growing high-tech economy by providing greater numbers of engineering and computer science degrees. In 2013, the University of Utah awarded 777 engineering degrees. Our friends next door at the University of Utah awarded 223 engineering degrees, and
Utah State University.
Thank you. And also, students have founded over 50 startup companies based on university research. So it's fascinating.
It is fascinating, and you know, we speak with a lot of these professors from the engineering department, especially at the University of Utah, whether it's bioengineering, software engineering. It has made me really aware of what a great university, couple of universities, public universities that we have in this state that are doing really forward thinking, forward moving things. So that's wonderful.
And then front-ending the encouragement of kids to get involved in STEM, which is an acronym for science, technology, engineering, and manufacturing, mathematics. I just wanted to put a shout-out to Ann Bastian, who was our guest a couple weeks ago from the Robotics First competition at University of Utah, which is encouraging Utah high school students to get involved in science.
And again, piggybacking on kids, we'll call 30-something-year-olds, and technology. You know, I love that we founded Cool Science Radio, but I think I would have rather have founded WhatsApp. Did you hear about the $19 billion purchase by Facebook of WhatsApp, which I hadn't even heard about until yesterday? And actually, I checked with my 15-year-old this morning. He's never heard of it. So who has heard of it? Well, 450 million people around the world use WhatsApp. It's a text messaging service, costs $1 a year.
Really?
Facebook just purchased it for $19 billion, making this 37-year-old
Now, where are most of those 450 million people?
Well, apparently, a lot of them are in countries like India. Mm-hmm. And across Asia and the rest of the world. We're not using it so much here, maybe because our text messaging is cheaper. I don't know. But how about that? I mean, it just shows you Facebook, while people think it's getting stale, they are innovating so that they can remain viable for certain. So there you go. That's today. Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If Google purchased Cool Science Radio, what do you think, $10?
Something like that. You're listening to KPCW Park City.